Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I'm your host for the weekend show and your host throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and also on our podcast, Corlin Economics Report. This was another very busy week full of company updates, a couple more company introductions that I provided, as well as a lot of commentary on some of the market moves. We did have a Fed meeting, not a whole lot came out of that Fed meeting. But the story that really took charge and took hold of all the media sources and quite frankly had almost anybody following the markets and even those people who don't follow the markets talking about it was this move in GameStop. Now, the stock went absolutely crazy this week. Really at the tail end of the prior week, it started to move, and it's all moving because of, I guess, these new online traders, a new group of retail traders that are using social media and using this Reddit forum, Wall Street Bets, to really catch some of these large hedge funds and large institutions, especially the short sellers, off on a lot of their short bets. It's one of these data points that is really changing markets right now. So I am kicking off the show with Jesse Felder. He is the founder and editor of the Felder Report. Jesse, I want to spend some time talking about this new market dynamic. There's a lot to dive into here, but please give us your just initial thoughts on how this market is changing, all thanks to social media and now the ability of a bunch of retail traders, millions of retail traders, investing a lot of their money all together at the same time.
Well, it's a new trend for us, but this is something that's happened to markets during almost every mania that we've seen. If you go back to the dot-com mania, we saw, day traders taking over the market and sending, stock prices to the moon, just like we're seeing today. I think, the more apt description that I've seen is it's sort of like the trusts back in the 20s that would collaborate and to intentionally manipulate, create a buying pool to manipulate stock prices higher. Another good, metaphor that I've heard my friend Peter Atwater has called these flash mobs with money. And, if we think back to, 10, 15 years ago, flash mobs were a thing where people would say, they on Facebook or whatever, they'd get together and say, hey, let's show up here and we will all, do X, Y, and Z right at the same time. It'll be a hugely surprising thing. That will be kind of, fun. We're seeing the flash mobs essentially migrate to the stock market, where you have a coordinated pool of buyers who have realized that if they coordinate their buying power and use the most highly leveraged vehicles possible, which are short dated out of the money call options, that they can manipulate prices higher. We saw it in Tesla last year. A lot of the reason Tesla went up 1,000% or whatever last year was that we had an insane amount of call buying every week in these weekly call options. And what it does, and we've talked about this before, Corey, over the last few months, is that it forces the dealers, the option dealers, to go buy underlying common stock. So if you're going to go buy call options that are literally trading at 2, 3, 4, 5 cents per contract, you're going to go force market makers, and you buy them in great enough size, you're going to go force these dealers or market makers to go buy in the underlying stock in major size. And so that's what we're seeing in GameStop. We're seeing massive call buying volumes in the stock that's forcing the dealers to go buy the common stock and squeeze these hedge funds that, in the case of GameStop, have sold short 140% of the float. And so it's, that's how you get a stock that goes up 4,000 or 5,000% you know, in less than a year, as you see, without any real fundamental change to its business. It's just these synthetic or structural things that are going on beneath the market surface.
Yeah, it's just crazy. It's a different market, though, isn't it? Because there's been some analysis done on this Reddit board, this Wall Street Bets. And you can argue that Wall Street Bets is the top 20 global hedge fund. It has almost 3 million followers. These followers apparently have around $6,000. That equates to almost $18 billion. And this isn't like a normal hedge fund where they diversify their bets. This is a lot of money going into one bet for a short period of time. Now, the argument has been that, well, this is manipulation. But in all fairness, for these retail investors, they can argue that the markets have been manipulated by these big hedge funds because they have been the ones that have the money. And now it's a coordinated event instead of from one or two hedge funds, from millions of people pushing these hedge funds into making bets or taking off bets that they have already made. Where do you stand on that argument? Which one's at fault here? Is this truly changing the market dynamics?
I think it has changed the market dynamic for a period of time. But, you know, Arthur Levitt, who's the former chairman of the SEC, wrote a piece for Bloomberg today saying, you know, the SEC is probably already looking into this and there's a lot that they can do to prevent this type of manipulation. And, you know, I'll say that, I absolutely sympathize with a lot of these buyers at Wall Street Bets. I mean, I think there's a lot in common. You know, with these people feeling, you know, disenfranchised that, you know, Wall Street got away with murder during the great financial crisis, was never held to account, and Main Street was, you know, left to bear the brunt of the economic consequences. And now there's this feeling that, you know, this is essentially, you know, I was mentioning flash mobs a minute ago. And part of those flash mobs we saw after the great financial crisis was, you know, like Occupy Wall Street, people coordinating and saying, we are not going to let these guys get away with this. And, you know, there was really nothing that they can do. And so this is almost like, in my mind, Occupy Wall Street 2.0, where they, you know, a lot of these people are saying, look, we are not able to express ourselves politically. We're not able to rectify the situation in terms of wealth inequality and all these other issues that are driving people up the wall. So, hey, you know what? I can't blame them for saying we're going to punish these hedge funds. You know, we're going to get back at Wall Street in a way that we've found we're able to. And, you know, so the sentiment behind it is absolutely understandable. And it is true. I do believe that a lot of these hedge funds were, in fact, manipulating a lot of these share prices lower. GameStop traded, you know, at 3x cash flow. Bed Bath & Beyond is one that I've talked about on your show for at least the past year. Got down to $3-4 a share before hitting, you know, 50 this week as part of this dynamic. And, you know, a lot of that, the reason why these stocks got so cheap was because these hedge funds were just pushing so hard on the short side. When you get, you know, 80% of the float in Bed Bath was sold short, 140% in GameStop. And so, you know, clearly the only players in these stocks at, you know, back in March of this year were the short sellers. And so they were absolutely pushing prices way too low. But now we're seeing the opposite, which is, you know, prices being, you know, there's no reason why GameStop should be more valuable than Etsy and, you know, a lot of these other companies that are actually their businesses, you know, are actually doing phenomenally well. GameStop is a struggling retailer.
So now you mentioned the SEC looking into maybe what they could do to limit some of this wild action. But you look back to after the crash in March, one of the reasons why the market has moved up so much is because of all these new retail traders, all these essentially services that offer you free trades like Robinhood, no commission trades. That has helped bring a lot of liquidity into this market. Now it's starting to, I guess, burn some of these bigger players. What do you think the SEC could do by attacking these retail traders, but not just turning this whole market over?
Well, I mean, that's the risk, right, is that they do turn this market over in the process. Because if you look at a lot of these, the broader market, to me, one of the things that I've been watching with this trend, the trend to see when this market is going to start to look exhausted is, one, risk appetites. There's a variety of indicators we can look at, but outside of these handful of short stocks, a lot risk appetites, Bitcoin is a good one, right? Bitcoin rolled over, fell 25% recently. But you can see the dollar starting to rise. Lots of signs of kind of risk off are appearing. At the same time, we're seeing breadth really deteriorate in the stock market. I mean, outside of the retail sector, you're seeing every other cyclical sector start to significantly underperform, which is, a real dramatic change from what we've seen since March of last year when, I'm talking about industrials, transports, a lot of these really important cyclical sectors have done, really outperformed to the upside. They've all rolled over in the last couple of weeks, which, you could take that as potentially an economic signal in the short run. But it's also, to me, a signal of breadth. The number of new highs within the index has been falling off the last few days. So there are signs that the broader market is susceptible to a rolling over here. But if you were to take really damage risk appetites by coming after some of this manipulation, yeah, you would definitely, I think you could see some serious repercussions, and not just a correction, but another crash in the stock market. And if you want to look at parallels, go back and look at Tokyo Joe. Everybody can go Google Tokyo Joe. Was a very prominent, stock pusher, kind of a pump and dump type of player in the stock market in the late 90s, who, got sued by the SEC very near the top of the market in late 99, I think was the time, December 99, perhaps, when the SEC sued this guy for illegally pumping up stock prices. And so there's a possibility that I would bet, there's better than even odds that there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on right now. Essentially, people buying a stock and then pumping it on a place like Wall Street Bets, watching the stock soar and then selling their shares. And that is not legal. It's also not legal to explicitly manipulate share prices higher. Absolutely legal to say, I'm bullish on this stock, and my opinion is that the stock price is going higher, and I encourage you to buy it. That's all legal. But it's not legal to coordinate buyers in an effort to push prices higher for no other purpose.
Okay. Yeah, no, I get that argument. But what about, because this coordination all happens out in the open, online, on these boards, and the fact that some of the reasons why these guys are pushing certain stocks is because they see such a large short interest. So they're saying, here's our opportunity. I'm buying here. You guys should buy here. It's just a new way, I guess, to pump these stocks, but it does seem like there's a lot more people winning and a lot fewer people losing. Those people more being, at least right now, the hedge funds. I realize this is a moving target. It's dangerous to say who's winning and who's losing, because I'm sure there's some greasy people making a lot of money here, but it's turning this market on the head. And I feel like there is this larger population that is saying, good for you guys for taking it to some of these bankers.
Absolutely. And like I said, I absolutely sympathize. And I was on the same side of the trade in a lot of these cases. I mean, I own stock, like I said, stocks like Bed Bath & Beyond until this week. Mesa Rich is another one I probably talked about on your show, which is a big mall operator, which, stock is up 100% in the last, week or so as part of this, because they had such high short interest. And that was actually part of my, I've written about this, part of my case for owning these stocks. To be clear, I never anticipated at all that we would see the type of action that we've seen. But I did write about Bed Bath & Beyond back in April that if we were to see 80% of the float was sold short, if we were to start seeing shorts having to cover, the stock wouldn't double or triple. It would go up a lot more than that. And you know, it's up tenfold since March, April last year. So I absolutely see the trade, and you know, see what they're seeing and sympathize with the sentiment behind it. But like I said, the difference is, and this is a really fine line, you know, in terms of being able what you can legally prosecute. The difference is, we've seen it time and time again in the markets, whether it's cornering the silver market to manipulate prices higher, you know, back in the 70s, or it's, you know, Tokyo Joe pump and dump scheme, or when you were explicitly, I guess, putting together funds and investors in order to manipulate prices without any other motive. To me, that clearly crosses the line. That's just my opinion. I'm not a legal scholar, but you know, it's one thing to be an investor, say the stock is cheap and these other dynamics could make the stock price go higher. It's another thing to say, we know nothing about the company, but we are going to jump on this bandwagon to manipulate the price higher.
Yeah, fair enough. We see all the shorts. Come on, guys, let's get in here and do it. It's just crazy when you think about how much money is actually behind this simple Reddit block. It's mind-boggling to think, and that's why you're getting some of these moves.
Yeah, and you have to also recognize that, hey, let's say there is, you know, the $12 billion or whatever, you know, there to be invested. Let's say only, you know, 10% of that goes after one of these trades. You get, you know, $1 billion. Well, that's not that much in the scheme of the stock market. But when you're buying these out of the money call options that expire in a day or two, you get so much leverage. They're leveraging that $1 billion into, you know, tens of billions of dollars in buying power. So it's actually, you know, I mean, my hat's off to them, because they have figured out how to essentially be the most powerful force in the stock market today. There's nothing else that has anywhere near the kind of sway in the markets right now as these buying pools.
Yeah, it's just wild. And even on top of GameStop, we're seeing AMC move higher. We're seeing Nokia scream higher too. This is happening on a number of different stocks, and it's happening right in front of everybody on the internet, on these public forums. So very, very interesting to see. Jesse, let's look at the broad averages, though. I am hearing a lot from my analysts that, look, these markets are overextended. We can look at sentiment levels. We can look at valuation levels. They are all at extremes or at very bullish, overly bullish levels. But these markets do seem to just have this money rotating within them into sector to sector. How do you view the overall health of the markets currently?
Well, you know, I would just point out also, perhaps the craziest stock that I've seen is Blockbuster in bankruptcy is up 5,000% in the last 2 days.
Yeah, this is crazy.
Crazy doesn't even begin to explain it. But in terms of the broad market, yes, this is the most overvalued stock market of all time. By the valuation measures I look at, whether it's the Buffett yardstick, you know, market cap to GDP, anything similar to that, you're seeing valuations today that are so far above the dot-com mania peak and even above the 1929 stock market peak, that to me, that, you know, there are two messages from that. One is forward returns. We've pulled forward all the returns from the future. Buying stocks today might mean you make no money for 10, even 20 years. But the other side of that is the risk reward equation. So that's the reward side. The risk side is stocks would have to fall 70% or so today just to go back to average historical valuations. That, not to get cheap, but just to go back to average, we'd have to have a 70% decline. So pair that kind of fundamental setup with sentiment, which, like you said, is off the charts. You only see this type of manic, euphoric buying in the stock market at the very tail end of a very long bull market. You know, Jeremy Grantham came out recently and said this type of action that we're seeing right now is usually consistent with the final couple of months of a stock market mania. This isn't, you know, something that'll go on for a couple more years. This is the crescendo. This is the final blow off. And, you know, technically, I mentioned a little bit earlier, I'm seeing a number of exhaustion signals. DMARC indicators is something that, you know, I use over multiple time frames. I'm seeing a lot of weekly cell signals and even quarterly and annual cell signals on the NASDAQ 100, the S&P 500, for example, which to me suggest the uptrends from on a number of time frames. You could go on, like, you know, go back to the uptrend that goes back to March of last year, or the uptrend that goes back, you know, to, you know, the early 2019, late 2018 lows, or even the uptrend that goes back to the 2009 low. A lot of these uptrends are technically showing signs of exhaustion. And on a much shorter term scale, we see signs of risk appetites reversing and breadth, a lot of breadth measures starting to suggest the rally is getting really tired and vulnerable.
So what does a correction or crash look like for you? Do you think we could go through another crash, maybe not to the same degree as we saw in March? Or do you think it will be more of a gradual pullback, a bit more level-headed pullback, I guess?
Obviously, there's no real way of knowing. I will say, though, that when these types of speculative manias unwind, you see things like the NASDAQ going down 80% plus over a 2-3 year time period. You see the 1929 stock market crash, which was, you know, when these things unwind, they're just as breathtaking on the downside as they are on the upside. And to me, maybe the best way to describe this market is you just pull out your Edwards and McGee technical analysis of stock charts, the Bible for technical analysts, and you look up what is this pattern that goes back to early 18. What does this look like? We've had a peak in 18. We had the VIX blow up, the short VIX blow up, sell off. Then you had another rally to new highs. Then you had the third and fourth quarter sell off in 18. Now you've had a new rally to new highs, and then you had the pandemic crash. And now we rallied to new highs again. And all that creates is a megaphone pattern or a broadening top pattern that's very, very clear on the chart. And Edwards and McGee are very clear about this. They wrote this a long time ago, that this describes a stock market that is out of control. And it's only ever seen at the tail end of a very, very long bull market. Usually what that forecasts is, prices taking out all of the lows that have preceded. So, you know, that would suggest, and I'm talking about the S&P 500 chart, that taking out the March low of last year in the S&P 500, from a technical perspective, that chart pattern suggests that's a very real possibility. And to me, when I think about what it would take to unwind, you know, what could potentially be the consequence of an unwinding of all of this speculative behavior, it doesn't seem out of the realm of possibility at all.
Yeah, crazy, isn't it? Okay, let's just wrap it up here with one sector or a couple sectors that you like long-term, trying to filter through all this crazy noise and some of these individual stock moves for the long-term investor that does care about putting money into a good sector, a couple good stocks, and riding that wave higher. Where are you seeing opportunities?
Well, you know, for several months now, I've been talking with you and your audience about energy. I still think energy probably has, and traditional energy, I'm not talking about, solar and new energy. I'm talking about oil and gas. And I do think longer term, I think there's a very good chance we could see an energy crisis over the next couple of years when demand comes back. And we've seen such a massive drop off in drilling and all these things, we're not going to be able to bring supplies back online very quickly. So once vaccines roll out, the economy reopens, we could see oil prices really, really soar. To be clear, I've taken down my long exposure to the smallest it's been since pre-pandemic. So it's probably pretty obvious that I'm not constructive on the market generally, but I do think over the long run, over the next 3 to 5 years, energy is going to be is going to go from the most hated asset class on the planet, as it was last fall, to being one of the best performing in the world. But we'll see.
All right. Hey, Jesse, great chatting with you, buddy. Boy, oh boy, just a very interesting week and very interesting for the broad markets. I hope we made some sense of what's going on. And hey, everybody, let us know what you think of all this crazy trading that has happened and how the tide, at least for right now, has turned more into some of the retail investors' hands as they have figured out some of these nuances to just absolutely scream some of these stocks higher. Jesse, it's great chatting with you. I love reading over all your stuff, and I really appreciate you taking the time on our weekend show. Have a great rest of your weekend, buddy.
Yeah, happy to do it, Corey. You too.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Following up on that last two-part interview that I just had with Jesse Felder, I am replaying an episode that was posted on Friday. This is part of a much longer discussion that I had with John Fenech. We move over from the short squeezes in some of the broad averages or mainstream stocks to now looking at some of the short squeezes that started to come into some silver stocks at the end of the week. I hope you all enjoy. Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. In this daily editorial, I am chatting with John Fenech. He is a portfolio manager and consultant in the resource and commodity sector. Now, John, I've had you on the show once before, and I was impressed with what you provide to clients and a lot of your analysis into these individual resource stocks. We are going to get into a couple of the industrial metals a bit later on, but I think a more timely discussion is some of these silver stocks or somewhat better known resource stocks that we're getting a little bit of a short squeeze in. Yesterday's trading, even during the after hours in the market, we were seeing stocks like First Majestic and McEwen Mining a pop in their share price. Now, both of these companies have large short positions that are well known to the market. And quite frankly, this whole short squeeze trend, and it looks like a bunch of online traders, social media traders, as I am calling them, have now started to maybe target some of these resource companies. We'll see what happens with regulators and their ability to step in, like we have seen this week. But what's your takeaway from First Majestic and McEwen Mining looking like they're going through a bit of a short squeeze here?
Sure, Corey. Thanks a lot for having me on the show again. I appreciate it. And, you know, we have both of those in full disclosure in our portfolio. So we were thrilled this morning. And, you know, AG has been something I've been in and out of as a professional trader for 12, 13 years now. We sold our entire position into this strength between 17 and 1990. Huge range there. We don't sell all at once. But we closed at 1686 today, and it's trading, as I look at it right now, at 1807 post-market. So again, getting another bump here. There's, you know, 23% short that we know of, and that's a massive amount of shares that are short. My buddy Bill Powers interviewed Keith Neumeyer, the CEO, today. So that went live on miningstockeducation.com for those that want to check that out. They've got a great story. You know, the issue that I have there is that they're 100% Mexico. And Mexico, as we talked about on your last, show, that it is a little worrisome to me that the country is being led by someone who may or may not be mining friendly. We'll see. So that's why we took the exposure down and we rotated that money into other silver cos like GPL that were trading, you know, flat for the last couple of days, even though silver is popping. As far as McEwen is concerned, I met Rob like 2 years ago. He's a very, you know, straightforward guy, and I appreciate that about whoever I'm working with. You know, he was basically saying that they had some operational challenges before, you know, many people figured that out. And, you know, as a former analyst, I'm able to ask certain questions of people like Keith or Rob that, you know, go deeper than just, you know, tell me about your whatever, you know, drill results, you know. So we saw caution in September of 2019. We got out of the stock at $2, sat on our hands, and now we've been re-entering here between 90 and 93 cents. Stock closed at around $1.18 or $1.19 today. So I think there's a lot of upside in something like that. Again, it's got 20% of the share short, and Rob, I believe, owns somewhere between 23 and 25% of the float. The other name that I'm looking at for a potential short squeeze right now is Fury. Fury is F-U-R-Y in the States. They bought East Main and have been under huge short pressure since, I would call it, Thanksgiving. If you look at the share price, it's been trending sideways. We put a buy on it at $1.24 and a second buy around $1.34. Closed around $1.41 today, so not a lot of appreciation yet, which I love. You know, I think once you get through that $2 Canadian price, which I believe equates to about $1.56, $1.57 US, you're going to see the shorts run for the hills, much like they did on AG and MUX today.
Now, John, in all fairness, the reason why some of these stocks are shorted, well, is because some of their fundamentals, some of their operations had some problems, such as McEwen Mining. Some of their financials were coming in a bit more, well, on the downside, right? And that was what was leading to these short positions being taken. How much do you attribute these short squeezes to some of these very short-term traders that see this opportunity and they actually don't care the fundamentals of the company? They just want to force shorts to be covered. How much of that is a factor here, and how much of a factor of the companies maybe turning around some of their production that is helping move these stocks higher?
It's a great question. I couldn't tell you exactly how much of this is, you know, the Reddit crowd and Robinhooders, but I would say that McEwen is going to make it, right? I mean, Rob's a billionaire. He wants that share price at a dollar or higher because he doesn't want to lose his key listing. So that's what I keep telling people. Hey, at 90, 91 cents, we're going to be buying this because it's going back to a buck. And it broke through a buck today. So, you know, we're not looking at McEwen as a home run for us, but we're looking at it as an undervalued play in the framework of a bull market for precious metals. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And that's one of the key factors, too, is that the bull market for precious metals, that can squeeze a lot of the shorts anyway. But it is just a concept that we all need to be aware of, is how much of this fast money is into this stock, because that then can really determine just how long of a hold it is.
Right. And so when you look at a website like shortsqueeze.com, you can type in MUX into the search field. You can see what percentage of the float is short, and then you can see how many days the shorts have to cover. And I think that's an important metric to look at. So if the days to cover on a stock are like 10, you know, that's really attractive, because it's going to take people a lot of time to get, you know, their short positions covered. And you've got a move then that would last a few days, you know? So that's something that I would recommend people do, you know, not just look at Yahoo Finance to get the short information, but, you know, look at shortsqueeze.com. That's a site that we use pretty regularly.
Okay, absolutely. Something to consider, and also just something to understand that, hey, if this money starts rotating into the precious metals sector, that can provide the type of torque that we haven't seen in, well, ever for that sector. You want to address that fact, just how much money is behind some of these traders?
Yeah, I mean, we talked, you know, offline about AMC and GameStop and some of these names that they've been in previous to our sector today. And these are much larger market caps than anything in our sector, period, end of story. So, you know, what I've always told my clients is be ready for a day like this, because traders pile in. They don't even know what they're buying sometimes, right? I mean, it's a euphoric time. So they may not realize they're going to move a stock as much as they do. So if you are selling, we tell people put your, you know, sell orders way away from the action on a day like today, because you just don't know how good it can get. And we've been waiting for something like this for quite some time. So we will continue to buy, you know, out of favor names that are going to make it, that have heavy short interest like a Fury, that have a plan, right? We're not just going to blindly buy companies, but, you know, Ivan Bebek's been doing this for 20 plus years. I mean, I'm much more happy to be aligned with someone like that than to be shorting their company.
Yeah, fair enough. But hey, it's very interesting to see this money start to flow in. Just as summary then, out of First Majestic, McHugh and GPL, so Great Panther and Fury, which one are you holding? Which ones are you selling? What are your strategies here?
I sold all of my First Majestic over the last 24 hours. I'll buy it back. But, you know, when you move from a close of 1389 to 1990 in a day, I'm going to take that gain. When you look at MUX, we hold 100%. We sold nothing because it's so short and so depressed. So we own that. We own GPL. We put a huge position on today at 75 cents. There was a big institutional buyer at 75 last 2 days in a row. And then we also own Fury and are building that position because it's an undervalued gold name.
Well, and even yesterday I came out with an update from Fury and the CEO, Mike Timmon. So I recommend everybody listening to that. It was on the back of an initial drill result at that Eau Claire project. Let's move over into some of the industrial metals then, starting with copper. Copper has been doing very well. Copper had a significant breakout at the tail end of last year and continued throughout the early part of this year. However, over the last about two and a half weeks, the price has faded from a high of just above 370, now just below 350. On a daily chart, it has even dropped a little bit below some of the key moving averages. But again, the run has been so strong for copper. What are your views on the copper sector?
Sure, thanks. So copper is very compelling in our view because of the fact that everyone is betting on an economic rebound, right? Globally, I mean, it's clear. You're seeing this in real estate prices, in the stock markets, you know, making all-time highs. It's like copper is what you want to buy when there's going to be expansion. And so I see us coming out of this pandemic in one piece. When that actually happens, I don't know. But, you know, as a chart guy, I'm looking at copper breaking out and you have to respect that, right? So if you look at FCX as one of the bigger copper stocks, it's really run hard. Not unusual. Same thing happened with gold and silver last year. A lot of the major companies like that have broken out. And then the little ones will follow. So we're buying the little ones. So we own Granite Copper, which is GCXXF. I just did a piece on Streetwise, which is with Cindy Edwards. I guess that went live January 26th that your viewers can check out. And I went into detail about why we like Granite. And Tim Johnson, the CEO, was featured on that for about 5 minutes. But, you know, they're got a nice big land package. And, you know, it's a good jurisdiction. And the stock is just got a new market maker that I helped put in place there in December, so it's got more liquidity. When I started to buy this thing, it was like trading by appointment, so it was very difficult to get anything. But you know, here at 14 cents, we really like GCXXF. We like Generation Mining, which is a combination of copper and palladium. They are coming out with a feasibility study probably by late February or early March, so there's a near-term catalyst that I think will drive the shares higher. We'll get into palladium in a minute, Corey, but, you know, I used to write on palladium for Sprott and, feel very comfortable with, the jurisdiction they're in as well. There aren't a lot of palladium plays outside of South Africa and Russia that you can buy as a, you know, investor. And this is one of them. And that ticker is GENMF. So Gen MF. Lastly, in copper, I would mention one that is probably not on anyone's radar, which is Copper Lake. That ticker is WTCZF. I just met Terry, the CEO there, probably about 4 or 5 months ago. I started to buy the stock at 0.013 this summer because I said, why is this, you know, stock that has copper in the name, a palladium deposit, and has like gold and silver, you know, trading so poorly? In talking to Terry, it's really interesting that Dundee had owned a ton of the shares and dumped the shares and really hurt the chart. Like, I mean, they took it from 3.5 cents US to like a penny and it never recovered. This is, if you look at the chart in the fourth quarter of 2019. So 2020 was sort of a comeback year for them. And now the stock's breaking out. They came out with drill results 2 days ago. They were going to drill four holes, ended up drilling three. but they came across more silver in those holes than they expected. So they were encouraged by that. And that's Marshall Lake. Their Norton Lake property is the one that I am excited about as a palladium guy because, again, great jurisdiction in Canada and people want palladium. There's literally a supply shortage that is going to continue, in my view, for many months.
Okay, so betting on this whole economic restart whenever that might come. Just one follow-up quick question when it comes to copper. We've seen a lot more copper companies come into the market. That's what happens when a metal, especially one as well-known as copper, starts to run. Where's the sweet spot when it comes to copper companies then? Because you have advanced projects that have been advanced and de-risked over a number of years, but they have huge capexes, but they also don't necessarily stand out because there's a number of them. But now there's a whole lot more exploration plays that are in the market. So where are you finding the sweet spot?
Mm-hmm. So much like we talked about a couple weeks ago, when you looked at the rally in gold and silver stocks, it was royalties first, big cap names second, and then the juniors and mid-tiers followed, right? And so that progression is going to happen in copper and palladium, in my view. So we're buying the small stuff because if you look at FCX or SCCO, the big copper names, they've already run. You know, and I'm not saying you couldn't buy them here. You absolutely could. But I'd rather buy a Granite at 9 cents and have it go to 20 and then, you know, settle down here at 14 and reload and watch it go to 20 again, you know, and make 100 and whatever percent as opposed to, you know, buying FCX and making 20%. So the names I just gave you are flying under the radar. These are names that did not make a big institutional list like Deutsche Bank put out last week. You know, I think they named like 37 copper names that they like, and none of those names I just gave your listeners were on the list. It's like, that's what I'm looking for. I want to buy stuff before it makes a big institutional list or before the analysts start figuring things out.
Yeah, makes sense. Go find that undervalued stuff. That just takes a lot of work. But hey, I respect that you are doing that. And what about palladium then? You've already mentioned a couple blended companies that have some palladium exposure. But palladium, in all fairness, has been a bit more range bound than, say, copper that went through its major breakout.
That's true. But 82% of the world's palladium is made and found in two places. That's Russia, which, you know, not a fan of, and South Africa, which is, you know, strikes like clockwork every 9 to 12 months, right? So you've got that potential for striking in South Africa all the time. That's over 40% of the world's palladium right there. I know this because one of my biggest holdings that I recently sold, Sibanye, SBSW, is a major player there, and I've gotten to know James and Neil on the team very well. And they you know, have turned me on to different things, different dynamics about that market. What I would recommend people look at is when you have a Sibanye, look at their palladium assets, right? So they're going to be in South Africa, but they're also in Montana. And so when you look at where the name still Sibanye Stillwater comes from, it's because they bought Stillwater a few years ago. I think it was 2017. I have to check, but the former ticker was SWC on Stillwater. I owned that for, you know, many years. And then SBSW as a result of the acquisition. And then I asked, you know, Neil and his team, hey, what else do you like in that area? And they said, well, Group 10 is directly next to us, right? So that symbol is PGEZF. And when I say that I'm interested in the Group 10, it's not just about the potential for someone like Sibanye just gobbling them up. It's like, hey, if you're in a jurisdiction like Montana that is already permitted, you know, and proven in my view, then why don't you buy the Group 10 and sell your Sibanye and rotate that money into Group 10, right? That's what I did. So I'm buying Group 10 here, you know, again today at 26 cents. I'm like, I don't even know how it's gotten here, but it's going back to higher prices. I can tell you that. I think there's going to be some good news flow in the company. And that's one of my favorite, you know, palladium stories in that it is U.S. based for a good amount of their deposits. Another name outside of Generation Mining in Group 10, you know, we talked about Copper Lake, WTCZF, that has Norton Lake as a palladium play. And then one of our largest holdings we're starting to sell into strength here, which is Palladium One, which is NKORF. Great drill results throughout the fourth quarter into January. But if you look at a chart, it's trading at a higher, you know, premium than any of the names I just talked about. So as you can tell, Corey, we take money off the table in names like Palladium One and AG and rotate them into similar names, you know, in that same subsector.
Yeah, I got you. Actively managing it. And hey, there are some good gains to be had when you do find some of these stocks that sell off or completely underperform what the sector, the individual metal, is doing. Let's wrap it up with nickel, because nickel is another one that has been running. Nickel also goes along the same lines as a lot of these industrial metals. People are looking for more North American supply, let's say. So what's catching your eye in the nickel sector?
Yeah, sure. So that same Streetwise piece that I referenced with Cindy Edwards that I did January 26, I had the Group 10 CEO, Mike Rowley, on that. And I mentioned that around the 41-minute mark, where I said, hey, look, nickel is present in Group 10's deposits, and they're getting zero credit for this, and it's battery grade. So, like, you know, why with Elon Musk, you know, talking about this like every week, you know, you look at a Talon, which is TLOFF, not going after Talon, by the way, but like when you look at their P to NAV, their price to NAV, net asset value, it's around a 0.80 going into today's trading. You know, this is going to be far lower on that scale, below average, I would say, which is around 0.2 for the average. The other name that I own in nickel that I really like is FPX on the TSX. Its ticker is FPOCF in the States. And I've known that CEO for the last 16 months. It's been one of our absolute home runs. We got in at 10 cents US and have just been piling in when we have sell-offs. I would, you know, encourage people to look at that, because the two analysts that are covering it don't even talk about the fact that they have this band target, which could be as good as Baptiste, which is what they get all the credit for. If you look at Newsflow, September of 2020, they put a PEA out on Baptiste, which was, I thought, phenomenal, and the stock really moved on that news, but it has come back to earth. And so, yeah, we're buying that here, right here. At 52 cents US.
All right. Well, John, a lot to take in for our listeners, but a lot of stocks that you've outlined as to why you're buying them. I appreciate you being upfront in terms of when and how you are trading these stocks. Hey, John, it's great having you on the show. We'll be chatting again in another couple weeks, and I'm sure we'll be outlining some more stocks where you're seeing maybe some misallocations of money and some opportunities. So, John, thanks for your time, buddy, and have a great weekend.
Thanks a lot, Corey. Take care now.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are going to get a company update from Gold Bull Resources. We are stepping a little bit away from the whole theme of the earlier part of the show on all these short squeezes, because quite frankly, I think it is important to look individually at some of the companies that I've been having on the show, especially ones that have been releasing news. Gold Bull Resources trade on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol GBRC. They also have an OTC symbol, BLSSF. However, this will be getting changed in, let's say, the next couple weeks, maybe a month from now. I am chatting with the president and CEO, Sherry Leiden. Now, Sherry, the company came out with two news releases this week. I want to start with the earlier one from January 27th, outlining the Phase 1 drill program for the Sandman property. Just to bring everybody up to speed, this project is located in Nevada and did actually just come into the company very recently from the Newmont portfolio of projects. Now, the company is planning a total drill program of about 8,000 meters over 42 holes. This Phase 1 program is 3,000 meters over 17 holes. Give us a quick little broad overview here, Sherry, in terms of what the goals are of this Phase 1 program.
So well, half of our meters are planned to extend our known gold resource. So at the moment, we've got a 309,000-ounce resource that was published in 2007. We've actually got an updated resource that is currently underway based on a couple hundred additional holes that have been drilled since 2007. So half the meters will go to extending our known ounces. I call these the easy ounces. We essentially, there's a number of holes where we've got open mineralization that we can go and test those, the depth extent and the strike extents of these open resource. And the other half of the meters are the higher risk, higher reward holes where there's never been a drill hole into some of these geophysical or geochemical targets. And they're where we're really looking for these, you know, multi-million ounce new gold discoveries. They do represent higher risk, higher reward. But we'll have a balanced program in that we've got some low risk, medium reward drill holes going there as well, where we're pretty sure we can get additional ounces.
So in terms of these easy ounces, what is the strategy in terms of, you guys have four different resource areas, but is it going to be stepping out along strike, or are you going to be going to depth at some of these resources to add these easy ounces?
A great question. A bit of both. So at North Hill, Silica Ridge and Southeast Pennement, we're going to be going along strike. And at Abel Knoll, where we're going to drill our first hole, we're going to be going at depth. So Abel Knoll, for example, is one of our deposits that has ended in 10 grams a ton. So we've got a drill hole. The deepest drill hole in Abel Knoll literally ends in 10 grams a ton gold. So the big question is, how deep does that continue? Does it stop there, or you know, do we have a significant extension to that resource? So that will be a great hole and our first hole that we're going in with. We can't walk past a 10 gram a ton open at depth kind of resource.
How deep was that result in terms of the hole?
It was at about 200 meters, at 189 to be precise.
Okay. Now, in terms of some of the step out distances, how aggressively are you guys going to be stepping out at these resource areas?
A few hundred meters. So, you know, if we can extend our known resources by a few hundred meters, that the ounces really do start to add up, especially in some of our high grade pockets. And we're starting with a modest drill program, only 3,000 meters out of our 8,000 meters that's planned. And that's because we intend to drill the 3,000 meters and then we'll wait for our laboratory results. So laboratory results are taking quite a long time at the moment, given the gold rush and the gold price in Nevada. So we'll take a break for a couple of months while we get all of our assay results back. Then that will be able to guide us with respect to our phase two 5,000 meter program with respect to, do we go for some of these new targets that we're drilling this first round, or do we go back and stick to where we know the gold is and stick to basically the easy answers. So we'll regroup, and during that regroup time, the plan's to actually move the rig to one of our other projects called Coyote. So the news flow keeps going.
Okay. Yeah. So you're taking your time, but also understanding that it does take time to get these assay results back, and you don't want to just be drilling blind the whole time, right?
Exactly. We need to be careful with our shareholders' money and making sure we're getting the best bang for our buck.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, how about some of this exploration drilling? What other information can you give us on these new targets that will be tested?
So we recently conducted an IP survey, a geophysical survey, and our geophysicists really believe strongly there's a correlation between gold mineralization and the resistivity responses that we're getting in this X-ray of the earth. So we're very much looking forward to drilling some of these anomalies. They've also coincided with being along the prospective geological corridors and structural corridors. So we're in the right neighborhood. We're down the road from the Sleeper deposit, which was a 3 million ounce, very high grade deposit that's located about 25 kilometers along strike of the Sandman corridor. So it's certainly the right neighborhood to be testing some of these scientific concepts. And we've got a lot of robust data to support these targets. So I'm probably more excited to test some of those high risk, high reward kind of targets.
Oh, absolutely. Those can add some torque to the underlying share price. How deep are some of these holes going to be at these new targets?
We've got a maximum hole depth of about 300 meters, so not very deep in the scheme of things. And the average hole depth will probably be more like 150 to 200 meters.
So is this exploration, is it focused on high grade? Do you think that you have the chance of hitting some high grade resources here? Or do you think you're seeing some maybe more lower grade resources that are near to surface? What do you think is possible?
Certainly, we'll be getting a bit of both, or the targets are both, because we've got this relatively, we'll call it low grade. It ranges from 0.5 gram to 1 gram a ton of oxide material sitting at the surface. And they're highly attractive numbers for oxide material in Nevada, great for heap leach. And we've got metallurgical data that says that the recoveries are over 80%. So that's the low grade at surface. And that's certainly a viable target in its own right. And then there's the high-grade feeder zones or targets that we've got a couple of intersections here and there, and such as that 10-gram a ton intersection at 190 metres at Abel Knoll. And we'll also be targeting a couple of those high-grade hits. And then the IP responses, that they're just going to be a bit of a surprise with respect to whether they're low-grade or high-grade halos, if at all.
All right. That, I think, sums it up for the initial phase one drill program. Let's talk about the other news release that came out on Friday, January 29th. There are some new gold targets defined, as well as an expansion in that Sandman land package. Let's start with that land package expansion, because you have expanded that land package by about 24%. Sherry, was all this land just available? It was unstaked. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's just astonishing, you know, given how hot gold is and how hot Nevada is, that there's actually available land still to stake. So we've picked that up on open ground for very low cost, and we've increased our land holding by 28 square kilometers. So that's it's a massive increase to our land holding for very little additional cost. And we based this on science. We had a geological and geophysical team go over this corridor. We've picked structural trends that correlate nicely with gold anomalism at the surface, and also some very interesting geophysical trends, shall we say. So it's still early stages, but we're very much looking forward to advancing those early stage projects in the background behind the scenes as we commence our drill program.
So are you going to be doing some work there in the near term, or was this simply just a play to tie up some of that land because you are seeing the possible carryover of your deposit into this open land?
A bit of both. They're on the right trend. So like, for example, if our high risk, high reward plays work out positive, then these are just an extension of those same areas. And also, there are some compelling gold anomalies and exploration targets that our team will be going out and doing some more detailed mapping, probably doing some 3D IP geophysics at a later date. Currently, we're actually got the 3D IP geophysics team busy at Coyote, but they'll be certainly coming back to Sandman later on in this year. And we really look forward to defining our targets. At the moment, our problem is we have too many targets. So we're trying to use robust science to really narrow down our targets and get them to being within that 8,000 meter drill program that we intend to do over the next 6 months or so.
Okay, just a quick follow-up then back on that drill program. When do you expect to start drilling?
We anticipate to start drilling, I'd say, mid to late February. We're all ready to go. We're just waiting on one more permit to be transferred from Newmont's name to ours. And as soon as that's in our name, we'll be hitting the ground running. We've got a drill rig lined up. We've got labs lined up. So presuming we get that permit sometime late next week, we should be doing earthworks mid-Feb to start drilling in late Feb.
Okay, perfect. Now, the other aspect of that recent news release on Friday said new gold targets defined. What insights can you give us on the new gold targets?
The new gold targets were defined predominantly via the IP geophysical survey. We announced a preliminary update of some of that data, and we're actually still waiting for the full data set to be received. So that will be another announcement as soon as we receive all of our IP geophysics data, which I anticipate should be in the next couple of weeks as well. We can share more to the market with respect to why we're liking some of these targets, and again, why we've picked up some more ground in the area.
Okay, perfect. Now, just a quick little wrap up here. How much cash does the company have to get this drill program going and really move through that eventual 8,000 meters?
We've got over $5 million cash in the bank and no debt. We're fully bonded at the project, so we've got enough money to complete this RC drill program.
Now, in terms of news that is coming up, you mentioned a resource update. When can we expect that?
I'm hoping next week. So as soon as we receive the final numbers, we'll be announcing that to the market. And our resource geologist I spoke to yesterday is very close to finishing. So I'm hoping I receive it, you know, Monday kind of thing, and it's out to market Tuesday. That's the goal, obviously, depending on our resource geo finalizing those numbers.
Okay, now final comment. You did you have already mentioned this Coyote project. The company also holds the Big Balds project. Big Balds is in Nevada, Coyote just across the border in Utah. What updates can you quickly share with us here in terms of upcoming news flow?
Our geologists completed a really interesting reconnaissance trip there. They did a bit of mapping and some sampling, and they think they noticed some really interesting mineralization that surfaced. So we'll know what those numbers are looking like when we get the lab results back. Again, hoping that's in the coming weeks. And we've got the IP crew at Coyote there, and that the intention of that is that they'll be defining our drill hole location. So Coyote's another one to watch in the background for sure, that we'll be advancing behind the scenes as our main focus is at Sandman.
Okay, perfect, Sherry. I appreciate the update. I hope everybody enjoyed this weekend show. It was, I know, dominated by what was hot in terms of the markets, which was all these short squeezes. It'll be very interesting to see how all that plays out through the upcoming weeks and potentially even through the rest of this year. But everyone, please be sure to visit all those daily editorials that I posted throughout the week, and be sure to listen to the other company updates and introductions that I've recorded. I've been getting a lot of feedback on these company interviews, and I will continue to showcase companies that I think are interesting and try to explain the story to all of you. Everybody, please keep the emails coming, fleck@kereport.com, and I hope you all have a very great weekend. Sherry, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you, Corey.